Good evening and welcome to Atlantic Tales on Clare FM. On today's show, we hear about the Talties of Caharrush Quilty, whose family has been harvesting seaweed for over 100 years. Seaweed is one of Ireland's least used resources. As an island with thousands of kilometres of coastline, located in the warm and fertile waters of the Gulf Stream, we have an abundance of many varieties of seaweed. Although we currently use only a small fraction of Irish seaweed, this situation is changing. Attention has turned to the sea as a source of food, energy and raw material for a variety of industries. For some, though, it's nothing new at all. For over 100 years, generations of the Talty family harvested wild organic seaweed from the Atlantic Ocean in West Clare. Evan Talty is Managing Director of Wild Irish Seaweed Limited, but from an early age, sport was his life.
I suppose from here, like you'll see, our home house is just there beside the factory, but our days were just spent, what I can remember is playing football out in the lawns. My cousins live back the road, there's some other people along the road, and just literally it was non-stop. We had great freedom around here because we had the sea, we could walk back to the sea, we could go swimming, playing soccer, playing hurling, playing football, tennis when Wimbledon was on, darts when the darts was on. It was just purely filled with that kind of a love of the outdoors and sport, really.
Obviously sport, a big part of your life. At what age, or was it from a very young age, you were playing football?
Yeah, look, I have pictures there of my father, I think back in, was it 93, and we're going to training when you're 3, 4, 5, seeing all the older lads looking up to them, wanting to beat them. And I remember when they won the championship in 93, taking pictures inside in the cup and all that kind of stuff that went with it. And that's like in Kilmurry Ibrickin, football is a religion. So every household, the minute you go to school, Patrick Murray coming into the schools, teaching us how to play football, lunch times, fine days, out playing sport. And that was really the only thing, like we weren't into video games and all that kind of stuff at the time. It was really an outdoors environment, round bales, jumping up and down on top of them, out around with hunting cattle. That's what we grew up with, really. Like,
how did sport, do you think, shaped you as a person?
It's an interesting one, really, because I suppose it makes relationships and friendships for life, I suppose, that, like, from the lads that we would have grown up with, we'd still all be quite friendly, go for coffees, that kind of thing now. And it creates that kind of an environment of a community environment, but you develop social skills as well, I think, compared to, from what I see nowadays, where even a lot of my own relations and younger kids, they're very much introverts in that they're playing online and their friends are random strangers in other countries that with headsets on, versus your friends that you make and build relationships for in school and in throughout sport. So it gives you that kind of a sense of family and community because of the amount of people that you become friends with through it.
While three generations of Talties before Evan were heavily involved in seaweed harvesting, it's his life now. But when he was growing up, it was all about Gaelic football.
I'm still debating whether I'll play again this year. I played last year, but the year is getting harder every year, and the Christmases are getting, there's a lot more weight on every year. So yeah, we'll see how that goes. But I read something there recently, and because I obviously it's coming to that age, but it's like, if you're fit enough and you feel you're able, no matter what level, keep playing as long as you can, because you've plenty of years that you won't be able to play. So that's something that I suppose I'm looking at the moment. But it's great because, like I said this last year, I probably thought about it last year, and when the weather is like this, you're definitely thinking, no way, we'll sit at home and watch the Champions League instead. But when the summer and the smell of the grass and you look down and you see the lads training and you're like, it's not actually, and I say this a lot, it's not playing the games that you miss, it's the banter at training, it's been in the dressing room, the slagging, the chats, the food afterwards, the crack, that's what you lose that whole network. One, and you often see, I suppose, where people talk about leaving the WhatsApp group now is this big thing, but it actually is, because it's the crack that's on it, rather than, you know, and I'd say if anyone got hands on any GA club team's internal WhatsApp group, the last thing you talk about is football on it. It's all that kind of camaraderie and crack that goes on, and that's really what you miss. But as you develop, and that's why coaching, I suppose, now for me is something that I'd like to get into, because you're building other relationships and you're developing friendships, and for me, you're seeing it from the other side, and I've a lot more respect for managers that I mightn't have had in the past now, because I can definitely see it from their point of view, where they're coming from, whereas as a player, you only see it through your own lens.
Whether Evan will tog out again for his team remains to be seen, but he remains very active in football and has moved his attention to coaching. Over 25 years of experience in the GAA was the foundation for another business venture he started. Evan is founder of IGAA Coach, a coaching tool for backroom teams and players.
I suppose from my work that I do through the business development side, I would have worked with a lot of GAA players and helped them get businesses off the ground. And you're always seeing different things and other people's ideas, and that inspires me and gets the kind of the juices flowing. But it's something from a practical point of view that the GAA now is hugely concerned around tactics boards and these big boards, and you might see the likes of Paul Kinnock and these using them at half time. And I would have looked at other ones that are there for soccer and basketball and seeing can we improve it for GAA. So I would have sourced some stuff through guys I know in China, through stuff we would have sourced before, got them to make prototypes, brought them in and looked at what we can do for it then and how we can improve it. Got some good manufacturing done, brought in 100 boards. They sold like wildfire, and we've probably sold 500 in the last month, and we're sold out as it is.
Just physically then, for someone who mightn't be familiar with it, but their ears are cocked now, they're curious, what exactly is it then?
So what it is it's like a giant iPad for all the world. It's bigger than A3 size, so it's 21 inches. And what it is it's a mixture between an iPad and an Etch-a-Sketch, because it's a stylus pen with an LCD screen, and you write on it, and it's a one-click erase button then that clears the screen. So when coaches are trying to talk to players and show them, I think 89% of people learn visually better than anything else, and that's where, when you can show the person, this is where I want you to be on the pitch, this is what I want you to do, off you go. And it's really quick and simple, rather than lugging big boards around the place, or just verbally telling them. So I've been blown away by the response. It's not something I ever expected, because really I would have been happy with just getting rid of the 100 that I brought in and having a few free ones for myself, and it's really exploded.
As a young man growing up, it was all about football for Evan. He's a 9-time Clare Senior Football Championship winner with Kilmurry Ibrickan, but while in school, never looked too far ahead or really knew what he wanted to do with his life.
No, honestly, I was one of these people, because I think I went to school in September when I turned 4 in August, and I went to school in September, so I was quite young, which was common enough at the time to do. And so when I finished my Leaving Cert, I was 16, and I genuinely had no idea what I wanted to do, no concentration, no vision, and I suppose maybe a lot of people are the same nowadays, but I remember doing career guidance, and it was, the teacher was looking at me, and I was jumping from everything going the road. But I wasn't great to take instruction. Everything with me was lastminute.com. It was not great at planning or time management. So I suppose a job where there's a lot of structures and very rigid Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, you do this, this and this for the rest of your life, I don't think that was ever going to, I wouldn't have lasted very long anywhere. So that's where kind of this, and being honest about it, up until 2009 when I was, 22 or 3, we live, as you can hear from the sea, 500 yards from the sea. I had no clue what seaweed was either, because it skipped our generation. And if you told me when I was 22 that for the next 10 years I'd be selling seaweed, I'd have told you were crazy. So I think everything happens for a reason, and it's not something we ever planned, thought about, but look at, here we are. And maybe, I've done some stuff like this before, and people might say, oh, you have a successful business, and you get serial entrepreneurs who do this for a living, and for me, every day you're still always worried about the next morning you wake up, they might not want to buy seaweed anymore, and where do you go from then? So there's always that kind of, pressure on yourself to keep getting better and keep doing better, because we've a lot of employees as well that rely on us, so there's a bit of responsibility there as well.
Wild Irish Seaweed Limited is now a global leader in the supply of natural wild organic seaweed to several different industries, and it all started with first establishing what the local market for the product would be.
We put a lot of hard graft into developing a local market, from going to local shops, spending 2 years going up and down to the Limerick Milk Market up at 6 o'clock in the morning, just getting the name out there, trying to develop a little website. But you were everything. We were the packager, the harvester, the delivery guy, the accounts person. So it was a one-man, two-man band, and we had to do it all ourselves. And I suppose the enterprise board leader came to us and said, look, we've grant aid for rural development. Would you think about putting up a factory and making this a business? And when we built this, we thought we'd never, this is a monster unit, we'll never see the end of it because we've no use for that kind of space. But the grant aid was there and we said we'd take the plunge. And then, I suppose from there, we took on a couple of staff, expanded our harvesting network, and really we grew small year on year and started being more professional, learning how to run a business. And that was a big learning curve for me, doing courses, Enterprise Ireland, entrepreneurial courses, and really trying to put a bit of structure around the business, because we were kind of flying at the seat of our pants for a long time until we said, right, this is not just going to last a year or 2 years, we're going to invest in this for the next 50, 60, 70 years. So that happened around 2014.
What about the harvesting process then? How does that work? Is it as simple as going down picking seaweed, or is there an act to it? Is there a certain type of seaweed you pick, and is it picked in a certain way?
Yeah, sure. And like, make no mistake about this, the most important part of this business and the most important people in this business is our harvesters, because without the seaweed we don't have a business. And seaweed is harvested all year round, so we have lots of sunshine pickers, as we call them, that go out with the shorts in the summertime and they'll pick. But it's the tough guys who are out today, which they will be in these conditions, putting your hands into the water when it's icy cold, up on your back. That's the hard work. Like, that's where I suppose we're reliant on them lads to do that, and without them we don't have a business. So the easy answer is yes, anyone can go picking seaweed once we train them up on what they're looking for, how to pick it sustainably from a food safety point of view, what we're looking for. But at the same time, it's not for everybody. It's damn hard work, and in conditions like this, it's not easy work.
Okay, you haul up the seaweed from the beach. Thankfully, if you're harvesting on the beach here near Carrarush, it's only up the road a small little bit. What's the next process?
The next process is where we're standing here, not far from there. We landed in there and weighed up. And you can see them racks that are over there, the seaweed in the harvesters pop them up on the rack. And then it goes into this drying room over here that you can hear running at the moment. There's seaweed inside there drying since last night that's about to finish. And the process starts all over again when the lads come in from the tide in probably an hour or 2 hours. We go again. And that, the way the tide works with the moon, so we get probably 10 to 15 days picking every 2 weeks.
Coming up after the break, we'll hear more about the production process after harvesting and what Wild Irish Seaweed is producing in West Clare.
Atlantic Tales on Clare FM, in association with Nolo Loughlin Insurance Services, for all your general insurance and life assurance needs. Call Noel 086 845 9912. Visit o'loughlinfinancial.ie.
Welcome back to Atlantic Tales. For over 100 years, generations of the Talty family harvested wild organic seaweed from the Atlantic Ocean in West Clare. The family's company, Wild Irish Seaweed Limited, is now a global leader in the supply of natural wild organic seaweed for the food ingredients, pharmaceutical, nutraceutical and cosmetic industries. Managing Director Evan Talty believes the business wouldn't be what it is today without its harvesters, those who brave the wild Atlantic weather to bring the seaweed to the production plant. Once hauled from the shoreline to the plant, the next step begins.
So the drying process, again, this was part of our upgrade of our facility. It used to take us roughly about 36 hours to dry maybe 100 kgs of seaweed. Now with the new unit we have up and running there with the past couple of years, we're drying almost 1,000 kilos every 12 hours. So there's a huge turnaround rate, which enables us to get more seaweed out to our customers. So right now, Pat, the really the majority of our seaweed is being harvested, dried in our drying unit over here, and brought into milled powder and flake. And what it's doing is it's being sold out to the US, Canada, Japan, and mainland Europe. And the majority of people are using it as food ingredients. So nutraceuticals, pharmaceuticals, food ingredient. And that's where it's not particularly, a lot of our business isn't particularly going from here to direct to consumer or into shops. Probably 90% of our business is in bulk manufacturing now.
After the drying process, there's further production, obviously, Evan. What happens then?
So we have our raw material then once it's dry. And then we have to make the decision, what do our customers need? So it could be anything from packaging small bags and shaker jars going to Aldi or Lidl. It could be processing into powder that might go to Lush Cosmetics. It could be supplying a company in Canada that are putting into capsules. And every one of them companies have their unique spec. So it's a unique type of seaweed, a unique size to them. And everyone wants something different. So it's not one size fits all. So on any given week, our seaweed can be going anywhere all over the world, but it's a huge process to be able to get it to each customer the way they want it, because that's what we pride ourselves on, is having the highest quality seaweed on the market, and our pricing would reflect that.
What then is so special about the seaweed on the west coast of Ireland here in the Quilty area? Are there different species? Had you to research all that as well?
So that's quite interesting, because we'll say when we looked at seaweed in Ireland, had no identity, it had no global trademark, I suppose, that we'd no selling point, we'd no USP. And we kind of looked at the beef and the what is Irish seen as, and it's seen as a green, clean, and really then our main competition was in Japan. And you look at Japan, where the Fukushima disaster occurred and there was lots of radioactive stuff going into the water there. So we really set about marketing ourselves. We got organic certification, we got all the kind of data sheets we need, and we started pumping out material around best in practice, best in class, Atlantic Ocean, highly nutrient water, the pictures of Ireland, and that's what people are drawn to. And even though we can charge a premium price for that, the same as our beef or our shellfish, that's what we felt. If it's not broke, don't fix it. Go after what they've done successfully and market ourselves as an industry, not just our company, but seaweed from Ireland as a whole.
The seaweed then here in Quilty, is it an endless resource? Is it always has been there, always will be there, nothing that would stop it coming in?
And yeah, that's a good question, because the easy answer is yes, it always is there, it will be there. It regenerates itself if it's picked sustainably. We would have harvest plans, and there's quite a large coastline. But from a business point of view, and you might be looking from an investment point of view, what happens if an oil ship goes out off the coast of Quilty and your whole coastline? So we've had to develop networks all over the coast of Ireland to future-proof ourselves, that you have to foresee circumstances where things might happen, but our business isn't affected and we can keep going.
It takes a lot of hard work, research, and of course finance to establish a new business. While Evan received some backing from family, he and his father Gerard also took the brave but ultimately successful step of putting themselves into the dragon's den.
And to be honest, Paddy, I suppose we would have always ran our business like a household budget, and that's not the done thing in business, because a lot of people would say you have to speculate to accumulate and you can't grow a business unless you put a lot of money in and all this kind of thing. But I suppose we would have got some funding off my mother and father at the start, put some money in. My grandfather, who you'll meet later, gave us a cheque of €1,000 to buy the first labels we had, the first bags we had, and that was really the initial investment that went in. But from there on out, it has to wash its own face, and it has to. We would have invested a lot of profits back into the business, so we still do that. And we went on Dragon's Den, I suppose, with two minds. The money was one thing, and that wasn't the main thing. The main thing was to get the name out there. And when you're on RT and you're getting your name out in front of a lot of different companies, and there's a lot of press around it, it's to kick on for years after from that was the main benefit from it.
With two separate offers for the full amount from Gavin and Alison, this father and son team must decide if they will part with a quarter or 15% of their company.
Gavin, Alison, thanks very much for both your offers. We put a bit of value on what we have done to date, and we're just wondering, is there any negotiation on the percentage?
Alison? I certainly wouldn't go to 5%. I think there's a lot of time required to try and refocus the business down the right route. Mm-hmm. But I would be willing to go to 10 and allow you to buy back the 5% if you hit your numbers in the first year.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sure I must smell like seaweed now to you guys. thank you, Alice. What I want to say is I very much respect the hard work that has gone in here. It's just a religion with me. Having money is one thing, but all three of us have the same amount of time. And when I slice and dice it, I have to be getting a maximum margin for me. So I'm out.
Okay. Thank you very much. With that in mind, Alison, we'd like to accept your offer.
Oh, I'm delighted.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Delighted.
Cheers.
We're in the seaweed
business. Was it difficult to put yourself forward like that in front of the dragons?
This is an interesting one because for stuff like what we're doing today or for stuff like Dragon's Den or let me up in front of 1,000 people in an auditorium to give a presentation, that's very easy for me. I don't mind that. But what I actually wouldn't be... I'd be less comfortable with would possibly be going into a small room with 2 to 3 people and trying to have a shorter conversation. So I don't know what that is, but I feel more comfortable when you're doing other stuff, the bigger stuff rather than the smaller stuff. So I'd be more nervous going into a buyer on a one-to-one versus going in giving a big presentation. So I think you have to, if you're looking to be in business, you have to have thick skin, because you're going to get more rejections than you are anything else. And if you can't take the rejection with a pinch of salt and not take it personally, then I don't think you're going to go too far. Because if I sit in that office every day and wait for customers to come to me, we won't last very long.
Evan and his father, Gerard, were successful in pitching for a €50,000 investment from Alison Kauser, one of the four dragons. This was a game changer for the business on a number of fronts.
Yeah, Dragon's Den was probably the kickstart that we needed to take us on to the next level. And the other thing that it was we were always a family-run business and we only had ourselves to account for. But once we got in Alison, it brought us a lot more accountability about the business and probably a little bit of external pressure to keep developing. And while like Alison is unbelievable to deal with, we have a great relationship. We find it very good to have that kind of an external, almost like an external auditor to come in, because when you're in a family-run business, you get very much bogged down on the day-to-day side of things. But she's great for the helicopter approach to see what are we doing in 5 years, in 10 years, and where are we going with this.
So is that contact maintained all the time?
Yeah, myself and Alison would speak regularly. We'd have regular meetings, session. We'd plan for the future, look at market trends, and look, she has her finger on the pulse in a lot of businesses, and particularly in the food industry. And she has great foresight in that area.
The one thing you certainly have done is you put yourself out there, and you have to make the business a success, because there are people now depending on you. You're contributing to the local economy as well. What about Ireland's Best Entrepreneur? How did that come about, and why did you get involved in that?
It's something that the Enterprise Board ran there, and we would have got great backing from Padraig and the staff over at the Clare in local enterprise office. And it's in their best interest, I suppose. Each office competes for projects in their own county and who's doing well, and probably it's a barometer for their office of what companies are successful. And I would have done the Clare's Best Entrepreneur, gone to Munster, gone to Ireland, and along with Enterprise Ireland as well, we'd have done something similar I would have done an accelerator program in LIT, which I found extremely good. So I suppose the one thing we had when I was doing all these things above a lot of entrepreneurs is with sales. At the end of the day, if you don't have sales, you don't have a business. And we were a little bit further established, even though we were young, versus people with PowerPoints maybe looking at what they will do, or people are just very much starting off. So I think that's what probably skewed it a bit for us in terms of the success we had. But it was a great kickstart, and it gives a bit of confidence as well that you're doing something right.
Vitalities were ahead of the game when they set up the business because, as Evan said, they already had a market for their products locally. Getting those products onto the shelves of larger big-name supermarkets took a lot of hard work too.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was speaking with some young entrepreneurs earlier about this, and they asked me the same thing. There's no easy way, and it's just hard work by I would be on LinkedIn every day looking at who are buyers in each section, sending them messages. If they don't respond, I'm picking up the phone to head office, looking for an email address, looking for meetings, taking part in programs, whether it's Aldi programs, Lidl programs, Tesco's, whoever the programs might be, where there's an in for suppliers or companies, we're on that and we're trying to make ourselves known. And then it's about, once you get in the door, it's about selling yourself then.
Wild Irish Seaweed Limited is now a global leader in the supply of natural wild organic seaweed, but it's even more difficult targeting international customers.
Yeah, you have to have your ducks in a row. And I say this all the time to the lads in the factory here and in the offices here, that when we get big customers, you only get one chance to make a first impression. And that first order that goes out, that has to be right. And everything, what we try and pride ourselves on is we might be the fact, we don't agree to really quick turnaround times and fast, and we want to get things right. Because when you're dealing with a food product and it's going to an end consumer, particularly into the markets we're going into, it's not about speed or it's not about quantity, it's about quality. And I think if we stick to that ethos of just producing the highest quality seaweed on the market, it's not about price, it's not about a race to the bottom, we just do what we do and we do it well, I think we have a sustainable business that way.
Are you forever chasing that new customer, that next customer?
No, we're not, because I'll tell you, we're pretty much at capacity in terms of production. We have a new factory being built out here starting on Saturday, the foundation. So where we're at is we're fully loaded up with capacity. But after that, then we plan then to start seeking new markets. But we have quadrupled our business in the last 2 years, and now we have to build to scale.
Is everything in terms of the production process done here on site? So
yeah, everything we do is right here. So we try and source all our labelling and packaging within Clare, if possible, if not within Ireland, if not as local as possible from a carbon footprint point of view. We try and source, well, we do source all our seaweed material from the west coast of Ireland. And anything we can do to give back to the community, whether it's buying clothes or going for food or all that, we try and keep it internally within the hub here in the west of Ireland. So that's kind of, it's a pride that we take, that all our staff are from 5 kilometres away. And like I always say, this is when I was doing an entrepreneur, they asked, where do you see wild Irish seaweeds? And I said, look, I want us to be the largest manufacturer of food ingredients, seaweeds in the world. And they're saying, well, you live in Quilty, like, why not? Don't know. And I think the pandemic has proved that with kind of, you don't need to be in a central hub in Shannon or Innes or Dublin to produce a good product that the world needs.
It was a conscious decision by the company to establish, set up and operate in its entirety from here.
Yeah, all 100%. And every one of our staff, it was, let's not go out and try and source someone in Dublin or somewhere to come and work here. Let's upskill our own staff, send them on training courses, get them to upskill themselves to be best in practice of what to do, whether it's salespeople, office people, production people. It's all done around here.
Evan has plans to develop the operation over the coming years and is lucky not to have seen a drop in growth even in the midst of a global pandemic.
Right now, we would have 11 full-time staff working on-site, and then we'd probably buy seaweed from another 15 harvesters off-site. So overall, we'd roughly add between part-time and full-time employment, you'd be looking somewhere in the region of 25 people. Going forward, when we build our new factory, we'll have people working in construction on that. And then as we branch out and try and buy more seaweed and need more harvesters, and on summer times when students are off, we'll take some students on as well. So that's where we're looking at, is probably adding 5 jobs to that next year. There's never been a year, and even through coronavirus, that we haven't grown. And for us, there's no point saying it'd be a good year if we stand still or if we go backwards. It's drive on, what's the next thing? If we can't develop more seaweed in terms of production for a year because we're restricted on capacity, can we value add our seaweed that we can get more money for it by adding it into other products? And we're always trying to see what's the next niche, where can we go? So that's really what it's all about. For us is, we're young, we're ambitious, and we want to build this business here in West Clare.
Looking back at it,
in the early days when you decided that there's potential here for a business and to make a living, obviously, and to stay at home because so many people have gone overseas to work? Was it very, very difficult? Was it more difficult than you thought? Or were you the type of character that was able to take it in its stride?
I think you can spend a lot of time worrying about what you don't have, what other people have, and look at the downside. But I would always say, don't give me the problem, let's find a solution. And from that point of view, I think, particularly around the pandemic and shipping lanes and staffing shortages and 2 meters apart and all the stuff that came with that, you just have to find solutions. You can't, if you spend your time worrying about the problems, I don't think you're gonna improve what you're doing, and you'll probably take your eye off the ball. So we try and keep a positive attitude of, no matter what the day brings, whether our machines break down or just don't give me the problem, let's find a solution quickly and let's get back up and running.
Coming up after the break, we'll meet two more generations of the Talties and hear how Evan is sharing his experience and expertise with other budding entrepreneurs.
Atlantic Tales on Clare FM, in association with Nolo Loughlin Insurance Services, for all your general insurance and life assurance needs. Call Noel 086 845 9912. Visit o'loughlinfinancial.ie.
Welcome back to Atlantic Tales. Wild Irish Seaweed Limited, based at Caharush near Quilty in West Clare, is a global leader in the supply of natural wild organic seaweed to a variety of industries. Evan Talty is the company's managing director, and his father Gerard has been harvesting seaweed since he was a young boy. For many years, harvesting and selling seaweed was a way of supplementing the incomes of families living along the West Coast. There was a time when dozens of families could be seen harvesting seaweed on the shoreline around Quilty, but things have changed.
We did kind of seaweed in bulk rather than what we're doing now, so it was in tractor and trailer loads rather than in by the gram and by the pound and by the kilogram. So my father used to harvest the seaweed basically when it was washed up and it was cast in. He'd use a buck rake on the front of a tractor, pour it into the trailer, bring it up to the nun's place in Spanish Point in general to spread it out because it fertilised the field as it was drying. And then we had to rake it all up again by hand and load it back on the trailer. And when it was dry after a couple of days, and he would bring it to Irish Marine Products in Kilrush and sell it by the ton down there. I suppose that the other part of the business then is that he was an agricultural contractor. So with the tractor and trailer, we'd put an old scales into the back of the trailer, called all the harvesters in the area from the Cliffs of Moher down to the Bridges of Ross and buy the carrageen for cash off the people and load it into the trailer and sell it again in Glens and Kilrush, and he had a commission for buying it. So we've been handling seaweed all our life, and I suppose before that, my grandfather, before the closure of the West Clare Railways in the early 60s, used to burn kelp, and they salt the kelp, I suppose, was the original iodine that they used the kelp for. So it has always provided in this area, it has always provided a supplement to either small farming or people working in kind of part-time jobs and stuff like that. And it was always used as, you know, getting clothes for the kids going back to school, or there was a kind of a run on the Dillis before Christmas to get the few bob extra. I suppose similar to people in inland areas that salt a couple of loads of turf or a bit of timber or whatever, it was the way it was done. And 30 families in the bay down in front of Quilty, you'd see 30 families harvesting seaweed there. And from 6-7 years of age, people were out on the shore harvesting the seaweed.
Harvesting, drying and gathering up the seaweed again was tough work. But in hindsight, while the work might have been hard, the rewards made it worthwhile.
Like, I suppose maybe the description of enjoyment is looking back in it rather than on the day. Because when you looked into 6 acres of a field covered in seaweed with a four-prong fork and started to gather it all up with my brother Michael and myself and my father, it was tough going. But that's the way life was at the time. People forked trams of hay. You all farmer sons were brought up with a fork or a shovel in their hand. And you know, that's the way it was at the time. I think if we had to go back and do it the same way now as they'd done at that time, and my father used to say it was easy because we had a tractor and trailer to bring it up rather than loading the horse and cart, and kind of, you know, it was tougher times at that time. My grandfather used to tell me that if people have shore rights along the shore, and they were given it to try and harvest seaweeds and bring it into the inland areas and the market in Innes for market gardens and things like that, because there was no fertiliser during the war. And they would leave here, which is nearly 20 miles, 30 kilometres maybe from to Innes. And they would wait at the markets to sell it to the farmers in Innes. And basically, you say is that they'd leave them until late in the day to purchase, because the price would get smaller, because you couldn't bring home the seaweed anyway, you'd have to heal it there. So they sold it and often had to go to Six Mile Bridge or had to go to Quinn, tip the load of seaweed in home. And you know, when you describe what he had to do in comparison to my childhood memories, it was probably very easy.
The little village of Quilty on the coast of County Clare has changed very little in the last 60 years. It was then nothing more than a collection of small cottages clinging to the cliffs that overlooked the Atlantic, that Atlantic from which the people of Quilty drew their precarious livelihood. They had few luxuries in those days, and even the essentials were often in short supply. The menfolk were mostly fishermen, who daily risked their lives on the ocean in their lightly built canoes. Those who remained on land still lived by the sea, collecting the seaweed that was cast up on the rocky shore and spreading it out to dry.
Ireland's tradition of kelp harvesting dates back to the 17th century. Coastal communities gathered kelp from the shoreline, especially after a storm, and burnt it in stone circles known as kelp kilns, the ruins of which can still be seen along the west coast. Gerard's father Michael, Evan's grandfather, now in his 80s, remembers his many years picking seaweed and kelp in Carrarush.
I go back to the first thing of picking seaweed was they were making kelp to be in Burton that time. Well, that's my first memory of it. And they have a big long fire, a hole dug out in the ground and to be lined with stones and all. Big long, it'd be about 4 or 5 metres long anyway. And to be burned there, and the best stuff that they'd get the best out of was for the kelp was stuff called sea rods, and you get in winter time, and the may weed grows out of the head of the sea rod, but the rods they were dried across the wall, and they could be there for months, and they'd be really dried out, and they were for the kelp, that was the best that was tested. And that was where the best kelp came out of the rods was, you know. They burned all kinds of seaweed, though. Not alone particularly that, but it'd be lit in the evening. They'd look after it all to be burning all night. And when it would be burned out, whatever stage it was, it would be wet in, and it'd sit. And they'd dig it out with spades or shovels and that thing. They bring it to Quilty to be weighed, and there was a company in Scotland that used to come. Fairley and Company was the name of the company. They used to come, and they had to do a test, you know. And they liked some places. They didn't like anywhere where seaweed was, where there was a sandy beach or anything. Mm-hmm. could have to have sand in it, like, you know. But that was my first memory of the kelp. That was the burning of the kelp with the fires. And the remains of the fires are still around and all the headlands around. But that went. Then the next thing that happened then, the two merchants in Kilrush started, Kirk and Kelly's. And they were drying it, and I don't know what process they go through. Really. And then the big buyers that came along were Glynn's, Irish Marine Products. They came along and they had the remains of that factory still there. It's there. But they were big, and they bought it from everywhere, and they came down from Connemara and they came from every place. And they were big into that, and they also bought Carrageen Moss, and they crushed that, and it used to be sent to America. It's crushed it into dust, something like what they're doing inside here now.
When Michael was growing up, anything gathered from the seashore was called seaweed, and few knew that there were so many species and how in demand they were.
The best price they ever got for seaweed was £2.50 a ton for dry seaweed. And that was the best price they ever got. And then they did come along, they would start to specialise weed. There was a weed called ribbon weed, which is kelp now, they call it. They're having it inside in the factory. And that came along, and that was expensive. That was, it was great money out of that. Which you had to hang it up and dry it and everything, like it, but it was well paid for it. It was 10 pounds a tonne, and that was a huge lift to £2.50, like, you know. And the ribbon weed went on for a good number of years, and there was big competition for that. They used to come down from Galway and buy it here too. There was a couple of, a couple of the companies that used to come. And they used to have, there was a competition for that, for to buy it, like, you know, but it was only seaweed that time. Now there's so many different lines of seaweed now, things, names of mine. I knew the seaweed, but I never knew there was a name in them even, like, you know. They were all seaweed, and that was that. And corrugated moss was the big thing always, that was always there. Like, that you could sell that, it was a way of making a few shillings at the time. You could sell it bleached. It'd have to be spread out and have to be bleached and turned white, and it, or you could sell it black, but you'd be, the prices, I was even buying that. I became an agent for Glynn's myself, but I was even buying that. But you get, in when I started, you get 5 shillings for a stone. This was all dry now, and you, that was black. If it was bleached, you got 8 shillings for it. They're still doing the carrageen, my grandson is doing it now.
You must be very proud that it has come all this way, and that your son and grandson are so much involved.
I never thought I'd see anything like this, you know. I'm always talking about the people that did. My grandfather, I'm 84 myself, and my father was 94 and he died. But if he ever taught, but he loved the Strand, because farming was, unless you were big into farming, like, the price for cattle was a couple of pounds for an animal and everything. And it was, this was great. It subsidised the farming, like, you know, for the people inland envied anyone that was near the sea. They could have, do that, like, you know, and have pick the carrageen moss and all that kind of thing. There was always a market for that, all right.
Evan Talty is the company's managing director and also founder of IGAA Coach, a coaching tool for backroom teams and players. He is passionate about sharing his business experience and expertise with other budding entrepreneurs, and believes anyone with a good idea should take the chance.
Yeah, and I suppose I don't have an MBA in entrepreneurship or anything like that, but what I do have is probably 10, 15 years of experience of trying to do things from a shoestring and being creative. And it's probably the thing I enjoy most right now is meeting other entrepreneurs, young people starting out where we were 15 years ago, and being able to impart on them the issues that we face, the problems, and being able to help them. So we do that through our consultancy business, where I would have worked with over probably 100 Gaelic football players for the GPA, helping them start up businesses. I also do it for the Enterprise Board and for Enterprise Ireland. So that part, to me, anytime I come away from that, you're really inspired, and kind of it's something that really I've a passion about, because I know their struggles, I know how it feels, and if I could have got that leg up and told, don't do this, don't do that, I would have loved that as well. But you always come away, every day is a learning day as well from them.
Do you often meet people, Evan, and if you did meet them, and they said, no, I don't think I can do this, what would you say to them? Take the chance?
Yeah, I what's the worst thing that can happen, I would say? Particularly, I'd encourage a lot of people always at the start, is the first thing I'd say is get a sale, because you don't know if you have a product that the customer wants unless you can get a sale. So don't spend your time on development and all this kind of stuff without actually testing the market. But there's no better feeling than, and it's like when I see my boards up with Andy Moore and Leitrim on the sidelines, and geez, that's my product. And that's a great, it puts the hair standing on the back of your neck, but there's a great sense of achievement when you do see that your product is out there, that there was a need, you satisfied the need, and there's customers buying it. So, and there's no barriers to growth now, no matter where you are, whether you're in the west of Ireland, Athlone, Dublin, there's remote access everywhere. Everywhere is online, so there's no excuses. You have a global market at the touch of a button through the internet at the moment. So I think I would encourage anyone that if you're a free spirit and you've hundreds of ideas in your head every day, just get something out there, go to the enterprise boards, go to the people who know what they're doing and get it up and running. The worst thing that can happen is you can go back to your job again afterwards.
Four generations of the Talties and many other families in the Quilty area harvested seaweed to supplement their incomes. However, when people moved to work in farming, construction and other areas, several generations steered away from harvesting. However, Evan is hopeful that future generations will return to the age-old tradition of harvesting seaweed.
My grandparents and both their different families before they even met would have harvested seaweed. The whole village of Quilty is synonymous with seaweed harvesting. There's documentaries on RT in black and white that go back to the 1930s and 40s. And you can see like 15, 20, 30 people harvesting seaweed along the beach. They would have picked seaweed in the summer on their school holidays to make money to go to the circus and stuff like that. And my great-grandfather back in the 1900s and the 20s and 30s, they would have brought seaweed from here via horse and cart over Tinnis and spent a day all going over and a day coming back to sell it to farmers in over in the eastern side of the county. So the history of seaweed in rural coastal Ireland from right away from the Clare coastline up to Donegal was really, really big. And then I suppose you go back to then, it died out in the 1960s and 70s and farming became more popular and the building trade became popular. And that's where it skipped a couple of generations. So like we've all, my father, my grandfather, they've all been brought up with it, whereas our generation probably hasn't, but maybe the next generation will.
As I stand alone on Reha Hill, I watch the sun go down.